Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 290 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. In this podcast, I'll be going over the USMLE Step 2 CK Rapid Review Series. This will be series 50. Yeah, this will be series 50 actually. And we'll be going over again a grab bag of things that are again very high yield to know for purposes of the USMLE Step 2 CK and Step 3 exams. In fact, I'll just say this. Whenever you see me make a podcast for the Step 2 CK exam, assume that is something you should also study for Step 3. I think that's kind of like one of the big things here. Okay, so let's just go ahead and jump right into it, right? So what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that, you know, this patient presented to the emergency room or was brought to the emergency room by their family, right? And the patient, it was noticed that this patient is like hypotensive, has been having a productive cough, and you know, they are giving this patient fluids, but the fluids and antibiotics, and the patient is still not doing well, and they have to initiate a pressor, right, to maintain the person's central venous pressure, which again, as you know, is the right atrial pressure, or the pulmonary capillary wedge pressure, which as you know is the left atrial pressure. Well, what are we thinking about here? Well, I'd hope you're saying that, okay, this guy has septic shock. Right. So again, in kind of keeping with our theme of risk factors, most common causes, prognostic factors for things, if you ever see a person having septic shock, what is going to be the most likely cause? Well, I hope that you're telling me that, oh, it's a gram positive bacteria, right? Having a gram positive bacterial infection is actually the most common cause of septic shock, right? And again, when a person has septic shock, what are some parameters you should expect? Well, we know that in sepsis or in septic shock, people release all these inflammatory mediators, right? These inflammatory mediators, they decrease systemic vascular resistance and they also increase vascular permeability. So when that happens, right, as you lower the SVR, that's going to bring down the person's blood pressure, right? So their SVR will be low. And if the SVR is low, if you really think about it, that means it will be easier for blood to escape from the heart. So the cardiac output goes up. Right? The cardiac output goes up. And because the cardiac output is up, then blood is not backing up in the heart. So the pulmonary capillary wedge pressure, which again is a surrogate for left atrial pressure, and the central venous pressure, or CVP, which is a surrogate for right atrial pressure, are both decreased. Now, one thing that people always mention is, but Divine, how about early septic shock? How about late septic shock? Yes, don't get me wrong. Those things are important distinctions, but those are important distinctions when you're caring for patients. That is not something that they routinely go after on MBM exams, right? So like these values that I'm giving you apply to early septic shock, and that's what you really should focus on more for purposes of the USMLE exams, right? So all this early septic shock, because I know some Q-banks and stuff, they like to go into the fine details. Those fine details in general are not useful at all on Step 2 CK or Step 3. Now, what if they give you a question about a 41-year-old guy and they tell you that, oh, you know, he recently immigrated from some South American or Central American country. And then they tell you that, oh, over the last like 3-4 weeks, he has been having like heart failure symptoms, you know, the orthopnea, paroxysmal nocturnal dyspnea, and all those things, you know, fluid in the lungs. Well, if you see that, I'd really hope you're thinking about Chagas disease, right? Remember, Chagas disease is caused by Trypanosoma cruzii, right? In fact, the most common cause of death in people that have T. cruzii infection is actually myocarditis, right? So they can get a myocarditis. And remember, whenever people get a myocarditis, they ultimately end up getting heart failure, right? It causes like some kind of dilated cardiomyopathy. So those people can go into heart failure, right? In fact, if you even think about people that have Churg-Strauss, remember another name for Churg-Strauss is eosinophilic granulomatosis with polyangiitis. The most common cause of death in those people as well is also myocarditis that again, ultimately will lead to heart disease. Again, whenever a person has myocarditis, always think of them having some kind of dilated cardiomyopathy, some kind of systolic heart failure, right? So they will ultimately have a heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, right? And again, remember, how does Churg-Strauss present? Churg-Strauss presents with, excuse me, they will have very high eosinophils, they'll have a lot of weird peripheral neuropathy. And then they'll also have something that I call a late diagnosis of asthma, right? Like just a diagnosis of asthma that's really weird, right? Like most people that get asthma, they get it as kids, right? But if you're chilling till your late 30s, 40s to get that first diagnosis of asthma, there's something kind of weird going on there, especially when you see like a lot of peripheral neuropathy and very high eosinophil, sometimes very high IgE. If you see that, you want to think about Churg Strauss, right? So the most common cause of death in Churg Strauss is myocarditis, you know, essentially, again, pulling those people towards heart disease. And also, again, in people that have T. crozier infection, excuse me, right? That myocarditis can give rise to heart failure, right? So that's the most common cause of death in those people. And again, remember, T. crozier doesn't cause small problems, right? It causes big, big, big problems. So it can cause a big esophagus. Remember, it's one of those microbial causes of achalasia, right? In addition to being one of those microbial causes of achalasia, it's also a cause of a dilated, so again, big esophagus, right? Achalasia, big heart, right? Dilated cardiomyopathy from the myocarditis it causes. And then it can also cause a big GI tract, right? Especially a big colon, right? Remember, it can cause a toxic, it can cause a Hirschsprung's disease, right? It can cause Hirschsprung's disease because, again, it can consume the myenteric nerve plexi that you'll find in the colon, right? So it can cause Hirschsprung's disease. And remember, Hirschsprung's disease can actually be a presentation of toxic megacolon on your exams, right? Because if you have a peristalsis of a part of the GI tract, well, bugs can begin to, you know, they can begin to grow, multiply, all those things in that region of the GI tract. And then the person gets in trouble, right? Person gets in trouble, and then they can get toxic megacolon. And remember, how do we diagnose toxic megacolon? We essentially take an abdominal x-ray, and then they'll tell you in the Q-stem, usually, they don't always do this though, they'll tell you in the Q-stem that, oh, the transverse colon is more than 6 centimeters in diameter. If the transverse colon is 6 or more centimeters in diameter, in a person that has, again, the commensurate symptoms, they very likely have toxic megacolon, right? So toxic megacolon can be a presentation of Hirschsprung's disease. And remember, Hirschsprung's is something we also find in people that have Down syndrome, right? Toxic megacolon can also be a presentation in a person that has ulcerative colitis, right? But the thing is, some people may say, Divine, how do I differentiate ulcerative colitis itself from toxic megacolon? The way you make that differentiation is, in toxic megacolon, it will be an acute worsening of symptoms, right? It will be an acute worsening of symptoms. People will not have toxic megacolon for weeks and be alive. No, right? They'll very likely be dead, right? So pay attention to the way things move in questions, right? Like, it'll be a person, they've had diarrhea. It's very likely going to be bloody. It's very likely going to be a guy, right? Because it's usually guys that get UC on MBMEs. I'm not saying women can't. They can, but almost like 98-99% of UC questions I've seen on MBM exams are in the male demographic, right? So they'll have diarrhea for a couple weeks. And then you'll notice that, man, over 24 hours, over 48 hours, these people start crashing and burning, severe abdominal pain. They may have signs that almost look like peritonitis, right? Rebound guarding, stuff like that. If you see that acute worsening of symptoms, I want you to think about toxic megacolon. And again, toxic megacolon is not something that is just found in Hirschsprung's disease or found in ulcerative colitis. You can also find it in C. diff, right? Remember, that's one of the most dangerous complications of C. diff infection, right? Toxic megacolon, right? Toxic megacolon. Now, since I guess I kind of talked about Down syndrome, well, what is one other thing we should maybe keep in mind with regards to Down syndrome? What's the thing that is the most important predictor? What is the most important predictor of prognosis in a kid with Down syndrome? It's actually the presence of all these cardiac defects, right? It's the presence of all these cardiac defects, right? So in kids that have Down syndrome, if they don't have cardiac defects associated with it, they ultimately tend to do better than kids that have associated cardiac defects, right? And again, remember, the most common cardiac defect in a kid that has Down syndrome is an endocardial cushion defect, right? Sometimes on MBM exams, just to mess with your head, they'll call it an AV canal defect, an atrioventricular canal defect, right? And remember, the biggest risk factor for Down syndrome is actually having like increased maternal age, right? So when women are in their late 30s and they're having kids, then there is a higher than normal chance that those kids will have Down syndrome, right? Because the thing is, as a woman gets older, right, unfortunately in some women, it's not common, right, but it definitely happens in some women, they begin to have a lot of stuff happen at the genetic level, like maternal non-disjunction. Sometimes they may have this Robertsonian translocations, right? And then when the sperm comes, right, so the woman will be like, essentially, she forms a zygote, an egg that contains two chromosome 21s, and then when it fuses with a sperm that has one chromosome 21, then you get three chromosome 21s, and then unfortunately the baby kind of gets in trouble, right? On an NBME exam, though, if they want to get cute, if they give you a question about a child having two chromosome 21s, but then you notice that the child has a Down's phenotype, and they ask you about the mechanism behind the child having Down syndrome, then you want to think about a Robertsonian translocation, right? So you may be like, wow, I'm only seeing two chromosome 21s. But the thing is, what they may then do is they may show you chromosome 14. And you notice that, man, this chromosome 14 is longer than a normal control chromosome 14. The thing is, chromosome 14 is an acrocentric chromosome, right? So it's just these are chromosomes that, they have like one very long arm, very short arm, so they can break. So the thing is, one chromosome 21 may have hitched a ride on that chromosome 14. So you may be looking, you'll be like, wow, this child has only two chromosome 21s. Why are they having the Down's phenotype? Well, they have two chromosome 21s, and then they may have the genes that control many of these, essentially like some part of a chromosome 21 on a chromosome 14, right? So that's why you're seeing that, wow, they have a normal number of chromosomes, but they have those things, right? Because at the end of the day, they have like three copies of the relevant genes on chromosome 21, right? So that's why those kids have a Down syndrome, right? So whenever you see that specific situation, again, you may be like, Divine, this is something I would never see on step 2, CK, step 3. Think again, right? Think again. Those are things that your friends at the NBME could absolutely throw on an exam, right? So again, the genetic principles you want to remember as the pathophysiology behind Down syndrome is, one, think about maternal non-disjunction. That is the most common genetic mechanism on NBMEs. But two, another one you want to think about, it's rare, but it happens and it pops up on exams, is a Robertsonian translocation. And again, I've kind of given you how they may word that in a question where the person, you're like, dude, I got 46 chromosomes. Well, because a person that has Down syndrome, right, trisomy 21, they're supposed to have 47. So if you see a person that has trisomy 21 with 47 chromosomes, then you want to think about maternal non-disjunction as the mechanism of disease. But if you see a person that has Down syndrome and they have 46 chromosomes, you may be like, you have 46. How are you having a trisomy 21 phenotype? Well, they have two chromosome 21s, but they have a third chromosome 21, or at least part of it, that has hitched a ride on an acrocentric chromosome, usually chromosome 14. That's a Robertsonian translocation for you on NBME exams. Again, I kind of took my time there to explain that, but make sure you understand it. Again, as I think I've said many times, one of the greatest unfortunate things that is happening in medicine now is many people, they learn information and they have no understanding of said information. Folks, it's not to your benefit, I'm telling you. Before you start memorizing things, committing things to memory and all that stuff, just try to understand. When you understand things, you'll be able to answer questions more successfully. There's a reason why you see many people, they've done these memorization tools, but it doesn't end up reflecting in higher than normal scores, right? It's because the understanding is not there, especially on the newer exams. And again, forgive me for going on this soapbox for a while, but the thing is, the newer NBME exams are reasoning-based exams. Don't get me wrong, you do still need to memorize what you need to memorize, right? But the thing is, people will do like, man, I've done 10,000 flashcards or 50,000 flashcards. I've done 7,000 questions, but at this exam, I felt like I was guessing all through. Let me tell you this, the understanding makes a big difference. Because the thing is, when you understand something, even if they present it in a slightly different way from what you're used to, you'll be able to see right through it and pick out the right answer. All right? Because the NBA me, yes, don't get me wrong, there is a lot of new things they've been testing since, you know, November of last year. That's November of 2020. But many of the things they still test are the same things they've always tested. They just find a different way to test it, right? Or find an unusual way to test it, right? So they know that in some deck that exists out there, maternal non-disjunction, Robertsonian translocation are buzzwords people have remembered, right? So they won't just make it a straightforward question. You know, maybe back in the day they would do that. But these days, they can just give you like a karyotype, literally a picture of a karyotype. And then you count and you notice that this person has Down syndrome. I'm counting 46 chromosomes. What's going on here? And then they'll put all these different answers. And again, because they're smart, they'll put maternal non-disjunction as an answer. They'll put Robertsonian translocation as an answer, right? And then you know that people, again, that don't have that understanding, they then all that information they've memorized, it then just ends up not being helpful in the end, right? So I will encourage you, memorization is good, but get the understanding first. After you've understood, then begin to memorize. When you do that, your memorization will be more effective and you'll do a lot better on exams. I'm telling you this. There are people that don't remember as much as a person that has memorized like 50,000 different facts. But you notice that, man, these people, they are working on limited information, but they are still getting in the 260s, the 270s, the 280s. Let me tell you this. The thing that helps those people is they are very good test takers, and they're also just very good at abstracting the relevant information in a question, right? And they're able to abstract that relevant information because they have the understanding. I guess this is almost like a life lesson within the podcast, but I guess since it's rapid review, let's just get right back to it, right? So what if they give you a question about a patient that, you know, again, over like 2 days, they develop like this sudden swelling of the abdomen, fluid wave, hepatomegaly, blah, 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 blah. If you see that, what should you be thinking about? Well, I would hope you're thinking about Budd-Chiari syndrome, right? Now, what is the most common cause of Budd-Chiari syndrome? I would hope you're telling me polycythemia vera, right? Again, don't forget, remember, polycythemia vera is one of those myeloproliferative disorders. And again, you want to be careful. Many people, for some reason, on NBME exams, and again, I won't be saying this if I haven't seen this. Many people, for some bizarre reason, on NBME exams, they conflate myeloproliferative disorders with myelodysplastic syndromes. Those are not the same thing at all, right? Your myeloproliferative disorders are your JAK2 mutation disorders, right? Like polycythemia vera, essential thrombocythemia, primary myelofibrosis. Right. And in P. vera specifically, right, you know, it's a JAK2 mutation. And these people have a very high hematocrit, very high hemoglobin, right? Their hemoglobin will be like 18, 19, 20 on a test. And sometimes these people, usually they'll be men on an exam, they'll have like a ruddy appearance, right? So ruddy, R-U-D-D-Y, kind of sounds like a dog's name. But they'll have a ruddy appearance, they'll be red, they can have aquagenic pruritus, right? So they'll say, oh, that whenever they take a hot shower, they begin to itch a ton, right? And these people may even have like splenomegaly and all those things, right? Whenever you see stuff like that, and they may have like these chronic headaches because, you know, their blood is like sludge, right? Their blood is sludge, right? Because their blood is so thick with hemoglobin, right? So their blood is sludge and all those things, though that thick hemoglobin can begin to cause strokes, right? And again, these people, they can have a hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, right? And you may be like, Divine, why would he have a hypertrophic cardiomyopathy? Well, again, let's think about this for a second. If you remember the equation that details the factors that control systemic vascular resistance, one of those things is viscosity, right? So if the viscosity of your blood is high, which it will be in a person that has polycythemia vera, right? If the blood viscosity is high, then the systemic vascular resistance is going to be increased. If that systemic vascular resistance is increased, that means the afterload is increased. And when the afterload is increased, right, the heart is basically working against bigger resistance chronically. It's almost like having like a mini aortic stenosis, right? But the heart is working against resistance chronically, right, to pump blood out of the heart, right? So you'll undergo that concentric hypertrophy, and that can lead to a diastolic dysfunction, right? Contrast this with a person that has just straight up anemia. And again, I promise I'll get to the myelodysplastic business. But contrast this with a person that has straight up anemia, right? Again, just kind of being able to make these dichotomies. A person with polycythemia vera, we said, can develop a hypertrophic cardiomyopathy because the blood is viscous, systemic vascular resistance is high, afterload is high. Compare this to a person that has really bad chronic anemia. If a person has really bad chronic anemia, that means their blood is not very viscous, right? And if the blood is not very viscous, that causes like a functional decrease in systemic vascular resistance, right? So because the SVR is like always low because there is so little blood to pump, the heart is always working at elevated cardiac outputs. Over time, that can lead to high output heart failure, right? That can lead to high output heart failure. Because the thing is, you need to present the heart with some resistance so that the heart kind of like slows down a bit, like, oh, you know, some resistance. I mean, not too much resistance with blood that is too viscous, right? You know, that will cause hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, right? But not too little resistance to where the SVR is so low that the heart is always like, pumping out blood at high rates, right? And again, also obviously, if a person is anemic, they're hypoxic, the body's tissues need oxygen, right? So those tissues will be like, heart, we need oxygen. So the heart has to keep pumping blood at elevated rates, right? So if it does that over time, those people will go into high output heart failure. Because again, remember, the heart is a muscle. It can't pump that well forever. At some point, it will give up, right? And it will pretty much not work, right? So that's how people get into high output heart failure, right? So I almost think of it as a number line, right? This is a concept that I encourage you to pay attention here. There's a nice midpoint of systemic vascular resistance where the heart is like, great, not a problem. But then if you go too far in the systemic vascular resistance column, you're like, ooh, go too far in SVR with like very viscous blood, right? P-Vera, for example, you can get hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. If you go too little on the SVR, then the heart's cardiac output is going to be very, 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 very high all the time, right? So the heart doesn't have time to take a breather. Again, if you have really bad anemia, your blood is less viscous. And again, whenever your oxygen capacity in the blood decreases, cardiac output increases commensurately to try to keep up so that the tissues get enough oxygen, right? That can put the heart under states of high output, right? Person goes into high output heart failure, right? So again, just kind of keep those two things at the back of your mind, right? So P-Vera, remember, because these people's hemoglobin, hematocrit is really high, they're going to have a decrease in EPO on the test. Okay, they're going to have an EPO decrease. And again, we treat these people with phlebotomy, right? Which is both phlebotomy, just bleed them out little by little in a controlled fashion every month, right? So that, you know, they don't build up all those red blood cells. And many times you also give these people aspirin so they don't get strokes. It's almost like primary prevention because again, their blood is sludge. It's very thick, right? So very high risk of coagulating. Now, what if you get a question about a person that develops hypercalcemia? Right, and you notice that wow, their calcium is really high and it's in an outpatient setting. What do you want to think about there? But I hope you're thinking about primary hyperparathyroidism, right? Remember, the most common cause of hypercalcemia in an outpatient setting is primary hyperparathyroidism, right? But in an inpatient setting, it's going to be cancer, right? Like squamous cell lung cancer. In general, squamous cell cancers tend to be the ones that have the strongest association with hypercalcemia. Although don't forget that multiple myeloma, right? Because remember those plasma cells, they release interleukin-1, which, you know, we can also call osteoclast activating factor. Those things cause bones to be resorbed, right? And then the person gets hypercalcemia. Maybe one thing I think I should mention here is, let me go back to this myelodysplastic syndrome thing. I just remembered that I said I'll talk about it. My apologies, right? So don't conflate myeloproliferative disorders with myelodysplastic syndrome, right? Myeloproliferative disorders, that's polycythemia vera, essential thrombocythemia, primary myelofibrosis, right? And also CML is technically myeloproliferative. proliferative disorder, but CML is from the 922 translocation BCR-ABL. The other three that I mentioned, though, have those JAK2 mutations. And remember, in primary myelofibrosis, right, they will usually have that red blood cell morphology where you see like the teardrop-shaped red blood cell because the marrow is all fibrosed. Sometimes those are called dacrocytes on exams. Now, a myelodysplastic syndrome is a particular kind of bone marrow failure, right? The big thing you want to know there is usually they'll give you some blood smear, and then they will show you like a neutrophil that's wearing glasses, right? Like a bilobe neutrophil. Sometimes it's called a hyposegmented neutrophil on exams, right? Remember, that's what's known as the pseudo-Pelger-Hewitt anomaly, right? The pseudo-Pelger-Hewitt anomaly. The pseudo-Pelger-Hewitt, H-U-E-T, right? Anomaly. That anomaly is again, you can find it in other disorders. But on MBM exams, if you see it, they are thinking about myelodysplastic syndrome. And the thing is, myelodysplastic syndrome, the bad thing about it is it can progress to AML. In fact, that is the most dangerous complication of myelodysplastic syndrome, right? So I think since this is a rapid review podcast, let me go ahead and pause here. So again, don't confuse myeloproliferative disorders, those are different, with myelodysplastic syndrome, right? And in myelodysplastic syndrome, maybe let me just say this one last thing. They love to make it a megaloblastic anemia style question. You notice that a person's MCV is really high. But again, remember, whenever you see a person having a high MCV, and you notice they have hypersegmented neutrophils, they want to think about B12 or folate deficiency. But whenever you see a person that has an elevated MCV, you know, more than 100, but they have hypo-segmented neutrophils, bilobe neutrophil, neutrophil that's pseudo-Pelger-Hewitt anomaly, then think about myelodysplastic syndrome. So as we wrap up, again, if you're interested in the MBME Step 2 CK, comprehensive course, again, the course is also for Step 3. It's 16 and a half hours, takes place from the 25th to the 27th of March. If you want to sign up, feel free to shoot me an email through the website. And then also the MBME Test Taking Strategies class, it's on the 24th of March, right? So it's 4 days total, right? The testing and strategies class is on the 24th, and then the comprehensive 16 and a half hour class is on the 25th, 26th, and 27th. So if you're interested in those, just shoot me an email and I'll be more than happy to, through the website, and I can give you more information on cost and how to sign up. And then, if you need one-on-one tutoring for the USMLE exams, step one, step two, CK, step three, again, I've tutored tons of people for those. I've had people that have failed the exam. In fact, I had a pretty large cohort of people this past year over the last 2-3 months, where these are people that have largely failed the exam the first time, and then I worked with them for a few weeks, in some cases about just 2 weeks, and these people have all passed the exam. If I can I can remember for sure, like, there's a bunch of people over the last 3 months, they've all passed on their retake. So again, if you failed your exam, reach out to me and I'll be happy to point you in the right direction so you can pass on your next try. And then I also tutor for preclinical med school exams, third year shelf exams, and I do a lot of application consulting, right? So in terms of preparing your application for med school or for residency, preparing you for interviews. Again, I've been on an admissions committee for a year and I've advised tons of people, worked with tons of people that are now residents. And some of these people had very tricky applications, like no research, failed a USMLE or multiple USMLEs, have like no clinic, have not completed all their rotations, or even I've worked with tons of foreign medical graduates, right? So again, if you fall into any of these buckets, I can add a lot of value to your application, to your personal statements, to your recommendation letters, to your ERAS application, to your interview skills, to making your rank lists and all those things, right? So again, if that's something you need, feel free to reach out to me. And please don't forget to subscribe to the website, divineinterventionpodcast.com. Whenever I make a new podcast, it'll give you an alert if you're subscribed. And then, these podcasts are also on Google Podcasts, on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify. So please subscribe. Any bit of support definitely helps. And then please also subscribe to the YouTube channel, Divine Intervention USMLE Podcasts and Videos. And again, for people that are medicine residents, if you're studying for your medicine in training exam or your medicine boards, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for those as well. So thank you for listening. I'll see you in the next podcast. God bless you. Have a wonderful day. Thank you.